Hofstadt's Cafe Monaco Restaurant in Oakmont, online at hofstadt.com. And the Chelsea Grill, an American grill in Oakmont, online at chelseagrilloak.com. Visit us for lunch and dinner. Bring the family before or after the football game. And good luck this season. Both restaurants located on Allegheny Avenue in Oakmont.
Family Floors LLC. Floors to match your lifestyle. Family owned and operated. A family tradition of excellence in installation and service for over 27 years. Carpet, laminate floors, wood floors, sheet, vinyl, ceramic tile, and luxury vinyl tile. Full service showroom. Free in-home estimates. Call 412-856-1987. That's 412-856-1987. PA license number 031732. Trib Live Radio presents the Penguins Roundtable Show, featuring Trib hockey writers Jason Mackey and Jonathan Bombulli.
Wake up, superstar!
Hosted by Ken Laird.
Wanna go, pretty boy? Come on.
The best hockey talk in Pittsburgh, right now on Trib Live Radio.
We're gonna play some friggin' all-time hockey!
Well, second chances and first impressions, all that nonsense. It's only one game. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Get all the cliches out. 3-0 Dallas over Pittsburgh in the season opener. Much to talk about only for that game and going forward. It's the Pens Roundtable here on Trib Live Radio every Friday from 1 to 2. In studio, Jonathan Bombulli. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hello. Thanks for having me back. I guess I didn't mess up the first week, huh?
This is your show. What are you talking about?
Well, if I was terrible, I wouldn't be back.
I'd just sit here. That's not the case. Some would argue Rob Scuderi's still around. Well, let's go on the line right now to Jason Mackey, who's live in Dallas, Texas. I think you're still in Dallas, right, Jay?
No, I'm in Phoenix.
Oh, you move quick. All right, good.
I was in Dallas earlier this morning, early this morning, and then I had a 6 a.m. flight out to Phoenix, and I'm talking to you live from my beautiful hotel room.
Good. Did Rob Scuderi make the trip with the Penguins? Can we confirm that?
I can't confirm anything. Okay. They were supposed to practice here. They canceled their practice at like 3 a.m. Dallas time or something like that. You would think so. Although, you know, I'll say this about our show and the Penguins, our debut was better.
Yeah, right. Couldn't have been much worse by those comparisons. Or are we being too hard on them, Jonathan? I mean, what have you heard, the narratives you've heard coming out of the first game? Everybody's psyched, they're ready to see the Phil Kessel era begin and no goals, and obviously a lot of criticism for different players. But is it fair to react to this the way you've heard some people here in the last 24 hours?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I feel like... here's the big thing. If you're paying 50-some million dollars to your forwards, you would expect them to score a goal. A goal. And, you know, just one game, and any team will get shut out once over the course of a season or whatever, but it's the first game, so yeah, I mean, you don't have anything else to go off of. I will tell you this. When this team has been shut out in the past, or shut down, you know, either way, to me, it was always a matter of, not always, but usually a matter of the defensemen getting bogged down in their own zone. They couldn't get any transition going. They spent all this time defending. And therefore, the forwards weren't able to get out and do their thing. I didn't think that was the case last night at all. I thought quite the opposite. I thought the defensemen actually did a pretty good job in transition. It's just the forwards, once they got across the red line, it looked like they'd never played together before. Which, in a sense, they hadn't. I mean, it's the first regular season game with a lot of personnel changes. But in another sense, they played like... how many exhibition games did they play, Jason? Like 15,000 or something like that, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, 14,978, I believe.
Right. So it's not like they'd never met each other before, and that's sort of what they looked like. So if you're looking for some kind of connection, some kind of chemistry among the forwards, to me, that's the reason why... you ended up with that big zero on opening night. It was that there wasn't any, you know, on the good side of the red line, which is, you know, not always the case when this team gets shut down.
What do you make of that, Jay? Too? I mean, yeah. They're playing the Dallas Stars, okay?
Yeah.
This is a highly offensive team. We know that. And they're probably, or at least last year, they were one of the worst defensive teams in the league. And, you know, in a way, you know, goaltending was an issue. Theoretically, this should be a team they can score against. It says nothing about their goal prevention. Like, if they would have won last night's game 7-6, I'm not sure anybody would have thought that was weird. I half expected it. To me, it is a little bit of a problem generating goals. I think if I'm a fan, I can be comforted by the idea that they did get chances, they did get shots. I liked what they were doing with Phil Kessel on the power play. He got a lot of looks. It wasn't perfect up and down the lineup. Like Jonathan said, it looked like some of the forwards didn't play together before, but I guess for some of those guys, I'm willing to give them a pass. But against a team like Dallas, you think something would have worked offensively. I mean, this is not the Chicago Blackhawks or the LA Kings or the Rangers or Tampa Bay or something like that. I mean, in all likelihood, this team is not going to be a Stanley Cup contender, so you think they could have got one or two up on the board.
I could understand the Bonino line being a little out of whack given Dupuis' late injury in camp, Jonathan, but you know, Malkin and Plotnikov did not look real sharp together. Maybe just Plotnikov couldn't keep up. I don't know what you saw, but they did play together in preseason, right? There's not much of an excuse there.
Yeah, the whole those top two lines were intact pretty much the whole preseason. And I thought Malkin and Hornquist kind of looked like they were just thinking the game differently. And, you know, Plotnikov playing in his first game, yeah, you're more likely to see some hiccups there. But the Malkin Hornquist lack of chemistry, I thought, was pretty evident. And you know, I mean, one game maybe that develops. You would actually maybe wager that it would develop. Those are two, you know, high end offensive players. But it wasn't there last night. I find that interesting. And I also think it's interesting that, for all the talk at the beginning of camp about trying different guys with different guys in the top six, they never did that. So, you know, I mean, the extent of the experimenting in the top six was, for a half a game, David Perron played with Crosby and Kessel, and for another half a game, Pascal Dupuis played with Crosby and Kessel. Otherwise, those six were set through all eight exhibition games. And, you know, what's Malkin's game look like with Kessel on his wing? We have no idea. We haven't seen it. And here we are, already in the regular season, and we still don't have an answer to that question. I think maybe in retrospect, looking back, that may have been a mistake in training camp. It may have been a good idea to get some different combinations playing together just to see what you have. I mean, obviously, you can still do that going forward. But when the games don't count, you know, that's what they're there for. So maybe that was a little bit of a miscalculation.
I think we did, Jason, have Perron get a shift with Gino and Hornquist last night, but I think Jonathan's right, not a whole lot of tinkering. And, you know, you were there for the Dupuis announcement. How stunned were you that he is out 4 to 5 weeks, and do we have any clarity of what exactly is wrong with him?
Well, we know it's a lower body, and we know that it's a hockey injury. Outside of that, and by hockey injury, I mean it's not blood clot related. I mean, I wouldn't think like his foot fell off or something, but, you know, with this team, would that surprise you? But my interpretation of it is it's a fairly standard injury. I am a little bit surprised by that. I mean, honestly, I would be less surprised if his foot fell off than it's just like a routine hockey injury. Pascal Dupuis looked really good. He looked really fast. It looked like everything was fine. It looked like this was going to be a great story, and that still might be. It's just going to take 5 weeks to do it. And I liked his speed and what he brought on the third line, and I honestly thought that would be the first thing they would go to on the top line. If Chris Kunitz didn't work out, if they wanted to add another element next to Sidney Crosby, I was really intrigued to see what that would look like. I think that does a lot for Sidney Crosby, but the third line should not be their problem. I mean, whether those guys played together or not, I don't know. You know, the third line was on the ice for the first goal. It was kind of a situation where they should have been able to defend that a lot better. David Perron was kind of chasing the play, wasn't able to really do anything about it. Dumoulin and Scuderi didn't help in their own zone. I don't know. I'll give that third line a pass, but you got to look at the top six.
Yeah, what'd you think of the first goal, Jonathan? Because I agree, Dumoulin gave a lot of space there backing into Hemsky, but Perron not real good on the back check, and at the other end, to start it all, Bo Bennett flat missed the net, and the puck comes ringing out of the zone to start the rush.
Yeah, that's what struck me most of the play, is that Bo Bennett chance. That was his best. He had a good camp, Bennett did, and that was his best scoring chance, and it was real early in the game, and you're thinking, all right, there's Bo Bennett doing what he did in camp. And he shot that wide, and it came down the other way and turned into a goal, and then I'm not sure I saw Bo Bennett the rest of the game. I mean that metaphorically. I mean, he was on the ice, but he didn't make much of an impact after that. So, sometimes a shot goes wide and it turns into the best breakout pass you could even imagine. That happened to a certain extent on that play. I mean, that's the only even strength goal they gave up. So, I mean, that's really the one to break down if you really want to break it down. And that's, you know, that's just kind of a hockey play. Like, to me, defensively, I know people like to bury Rob Scuderi, and that's fine. I'm not going to stop anybody. But I thought defensively, I thought they played pretty well. I mean, just in general and in terms of handling the puck, I thought that was a perfectly fine opener. I mean, if you're playing an offensive team like Dallas and you give up three goals, you think, hey, you know, that wasn't a bad game because we're probably going to score five. I thought this opener would be like last year's opener, that 6-4 game against Anaheim. And it turns out it was not in the least.
I guess that's true, although, Jason, they did give up several odd-man rushes. It seemed like a string of two-on-ones there for a bit. What did you think of the Pens' D last night?
I thought there was a bigger problem than Jonathan's saying. That's the one thing I will disagree with a little bit. I don't like that Dumoulin-Scuderi pairing. And especially if you're going to have Scuderi playing the right side, when you're that old, and I'm not saying that as a criticism to Rob Scuderi, I'm saying that as you're an established veteran in this league. I believe he's the second oldest player on the Penguins roster. If not, he's the third. You get to play your position. Just play where you're comfortable. Brian Dumoulin, you can change. You know, and if that doesn't work. And honestly, I would like, I guess the scenario, you don't have a perfect bottom four setup. I mean, you have Ian Cole that you want to play in your top four, and that's fine, but who do you play him with? And you know, maybe you play him with Chris Letang. I really don't have a problem with that other than the fact that the bottom four then suffers. I wasn't wowed by the Olimata-Ben Lovejoy pairing, but again, what do you do? Do you play Ian Cole and Ben Lovejoy there? I don't know, but I don't know. I still feel like there may be a defenseman short. I would really like to see what they have in Adam Clendenning. If he plays well, I think that would create kind of a really interesting scenario where your best, and this still might be the case, honestly, where your best six defensemen aren't necessarily the six that make the most sense. I mean, it would make the most sense to play Rob Scuderi every night, but if you put Clendenning in there and he gives you the best chance to win, then you get into the argument of, do you play what makes the most economic sense, or do you play what makes the most hockey sense? And we've talked about this before. If you base it on the best six defensemen in camp, or who's played the best, Adam Clendenning's in your lineup. I don't know if Dumoulin comes out, Lovejoy comes out, Scuderi comes out. I mean, that can be kind of a coach's decision, but Adam Clendenning has played good enough to be in that top six. And based on what I saw last night, I see no reason. You know, maybe you keep the lineup the same for Saturday, but I see no reason after that, if this continues, to give him a shot.
What about Clendenning, Jonathan? He's had some experience, but less than 20 games of NHL experience. You wouldn't want he or Dumoulin on the ice together, given that, would you, right? Wouldn't Dumoulin come out for Clendenning if that's the switch?
Well, I don't know that there's a I don't know if there's an ideal third pair, no matter how you reconfigure everything. It's just a matter of there's three. If you look at the ice time totals, this is pretty evident. I mean, Letang is the horse on this defense,
right,
by a large margin. And then, you know, obviously people are comfortable with Mata and Cole, and they should be. And then after that, the comfort level drops off. So, you know, I don't know that there's a whole lot. There's like a magic combination. But I mean, I like Clendenning. I like what I saw from him in camp. But what I like from him most is the way he retrieves a puck and gets it out of the zone. And like I said, I don't feel like they spend a lot of time, an inordinate amount of time, you know. To me, the games where the Penguins don't score goals are the games where they're monkeying around behind their net trying to, you know, trying to retrieve a puck, trying to get it out of their zone. Clendenning will help you with that. That's not what they ran into last night. They ran into, you know, like I said, not connecting offensively. So I would be more likely, if you're going to do kind of a knee-jerk one-game reaction, I'd juggle up the top six before I'd get Clendenning in there. Just looking for, you know, looking for a spark for some chemistry, because they haven't. To me, what you do is, and I think this may be a Dan Bylsma sort of philosophy, is, if I'm remembering correctly, I like it when you shuffle up and you shuffle up until something clicks, and then you stick with what clicks. So just, you know, bingo hopper until something works, and then stick with it. That's sort of what I'm advocating.
And then Plotnikov in that scenario is out? And
maybe.
Somebody's in?
Sure. I mean, Plotnikov, the strengths of his game are his strength. He's just a straight-ahead physical guy, and when he's around the net, when he's that net front presence, so when Malkin and Hornqvist are doing some skill type of things, then that works out really well. That's what we saw in that exhibition game in Tampa, against Tampa and Johnstown. That line dominated because Plotnikov just kind of went to the net and did the ugly stuff. So if that works out, you know, I'm all in favor of it. But, you know, there's nothing to say that Plotnikov couldn't be effective on the third line. There's nothing to say that Kessel couldn't play with Malkin. I don't know that I make any kind of knee-jerk changes or anything like that, lineup changes, Clendening, this or that. I probably just stick with what's there. But if I were to make one, I'd juggle those up a little bit.
Penguins Roundtable here on Trib Live Radio. Ken Laird, Jonathan Bomboli, and live in Phoenix is Jason Mackey, our Pens beat reporter, getting ready for Pens and game number 2 tomorrow night, 10 p.m. Eastern time, the late night start. What do you think, Jason? Will there be any tweaks to the forward lines? And many of our emailers this morning wondering what happened to Daniel Sprong in the third period. If he's not going to play, why bother? Would he be an option to bump up to line 2 there?
I tell you what, before this 9-game cup of coffee is over, and I don't know, maybe it turns into more, I'd love to see Daniel Sprong in the top 6. If you're going to juggle your top 6 and remove a guy like Plotnikov, why not give Sprong a shot? I mean, the one thing I saw out of Daniel Sprong last night that he did, that's why he's here, is he shot the puck. He has no problem pulling the trigger, and good. They need more guys like that. He's got a good shot. That's why he's here. Use it. I would love to see him, and I think he fits on that Malkin line. I don't know why necessarily. I feel like that maybe because it's, you know, his game is probably most comparable to Phil Kessel, and that gives that ingredient on that Malkin line. So it's kind of a natural thing to put Hornquist in front, let him shoot, and it feels like it works. But I would just like to. That's what he is. I mean, he's not a fourth line guy. He's not really even a third line guy. Evaluate him based on what he is. I guess I kind of understand in the third period where you're chasing a lead, and let's also not forget he didn't play in the third period because they took 4 penalties, and he doesn't kill penalties. So it's not just the coach was rolling even strength line and said, no, Daniel Sprong, you can't handle this. I mean, they had to kill four penalties, excuse me, and just Daniel Sprong doesn't do that. I think the greater fault there is some ill-timed penalties. That seems to be a storyline that a few have swept under the rug. Mike Johnston was talking after the game. He didn't think they were legitimate penalties. Well, you know, you're close enough. You can't be close enough in the third period, in my opinion. But anyway, they're chasing. To me, that's more of a product of what kept Daniel Sprong off the ice.
Do you agree with that, Jonathan? And of the penalties, I mean, Bo Bennett got called for holding. That seemed pretty obvious to me. That's a good call. Matt Cullen sticked the guy who was ahead of him entering the zone. That was a legit call. It's probably the last two of the stick infractions that people might have a problem with.
Yeah, the Malkin high stick on a follow-through. And the, what was the other one?
Well, the Ian Cole was falling down and just sort of had his stick go up into Sagan's face.
That was, bad luck. And even the Cullen one was kind of, he just tapped him with a stick. Officiating is always going to be inconsistent. I mean, I think we've learned that over the years. To me, the way Sprong was handled was actually kind of backwards. I mean, if you have an 18-year-old offensive kid, if you're up 2-0, then that's when you set him down. But they were down 2-0. They needed a goal. And that's what if you give up a goal, hey, that's just the cost of doing business. You're trying to get back in the game. I didn't understand that. But I do understand it would have taken some creativity to get him in there because you're not going to come back with the Farnham-Cullen-Sprong combination when you're down 2 goals in the third period. Like, that line's kind of interesting in its eclecticness, but it's not the kind of line you'd say, go out there and get me a goal, boys. So I understand why you'd need to spot him. And I also understand that he's not going to play on the penalty kill. So, I mean, maybe we're talking about a couple of shifts that were missed opportunities. Maybe a couple shifts make a difference. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of him in the third period. And to me, I don't need to necessarily see him. I don't think Jason was saying this. I don't need to see him a whole game every shift on a top 6 line. But at various points in the game, situationally, that's where you could take Sprong and pop him up in there and maybe take advantage of something. I'd like to see a little bit more of that. I mean, it's not like, look, if you're out there scoring 6 goals a game, then you don't worry about you can maybe focus on Sprong's off the puck sort of activities. But when you're getting shut out and it's getting late, get the kid out there. I don't have a problem with that at all.
You know, Jason, it's interesting. This the payroll that Jonathan mentioned and the firepower that we all know based on the names. Yet last year the production was not there consistently. Last night you hear Mike Johnston praising Antti Niemi as, you know, Niemi was on his game. And we've heard that so often through the years, your eyes start to roll. How good is Dallas? Were they really good? Was Niemi just tough to beat last night? Or is there a problem here in terms of, you know, offensive production that goes back beyond just one game?
I mean, to sound Canadian, I like the process. Niemi was really good last night. I mean, you can't take anything away from the guy. He put a shutout there, and you know, he might solve all of Dallas's problems. I don't know. And like I said earlier, I do like what they did with Phil Kessel, but Malkin's line was not good. It was not what you would expect. And I don't want to do the "I told you so," but I've been saying for a while I don't necessarily love he and Hornquist together. I'd love to see what Malkin and Kessel looks like, and then go back to Crosby and Hornquist. Hmm. And people forget Kunitz, Crosby, and Hornquist, that was the best line in hockey for a large chunk last year. I think it's worth at least a look. And David Perron, again, is a guy who's played top 6 minutes historically. That's why they brought him here. Why not give him a chance? You know, Sergei Plotnikov, I'm sorry, he isn't really earned anything. I mean, he had a good game in Johnstown, and you know, he had a decent preseason, but I'm not going to call this guy a top six lock just yet. I mean, David Perron is more of a top six lock than he is, and you need to find some chemistry. So, again, as far as are there any glaring problems? No, I don't think so. I think there's pieces in place. I don't look at this roster and say, oh my goodness, there's nobody on this roster that can score. It's just they have to be put in the right place. And it's one game of the season, and even in that one game, I mean, they, you know, what did they have, 66 shot attempts, 37 of them on goal? I mean, it's pretty good. They challenged Niemi. Niemi was good. The shots could have been better. They could have got more traffic in front. Mike Johnston alluded to that after, but I think it's just a matter of moving a few chess pieces, and I think they'll do it. It's just how long does that take?
I feel like Kessel getting six shots is an interesting thing. Most nights, if he gets six shots, some of them are high quality chances. At least one of them is going to go in. But getting back to your Niemi point, I wanted to make mention of the Dallas situation. That's a good team that really goaltending was the Achilles heel last year, and so you bring in this Niemi, you bring in a new guy, and he's starting the home opener for his new team on a team that thinks all we need is a goaltender to be a Stanley Cup contender. It really is the perfect situation for a goaltender to really, you know, be in the right spot to have a big game. So, I mean, that's not, you know, it's not an excuse, but it is a difficult situation. Another team's home opener with a new goalie who has something to prove.
Yeah,
and geez, he had two assists, too.
Yeah, Jason, you pointed that out at the top of your story today. They'll get Dallas again for the rematch in a couple weeks at the end of a five-game homestand. So we'll see them shortly once again. What about Kessel's debut, Jason? And beyond just the shots and the chances, did you like what you saw from him both ends of the ice? And did Sid defer to him too much based on all those attempts?
Yeah, I think he did. And I think Sid has had that problem for a while, wanting to set guys up. And you know, he's such a great passer that sometimes he's his own worst enemy, that he can shoot too. Which is one reason why I liked him with Hornquist, because he tends to play more of a straight-ahead game and just get to the net, and he's really good there. And he and Hornquist just kind of cause problems for everybody. But at the same time, you're deferring to one of the best five shooters in the NHL, maybe one of the best three. So it's really not that bad. As far as what I saw from Kessel, I liked it. I liked what they did on the power play with Kessel. I don't like having Crosby and Malkin separated, but their use of Kessel, him in the left circle, and it seemed like that was really a focal point to get him the puck, and he got a lot of good looks. And honestly, if they keep doing that, I have a lot of faith that the next night they're going to have them go in, and it's really just something where you don't want to get discouraged. I thought Kessel, he showed his first kind of chink in the media armor last night.
Uh-oh.
He got pressed about chances, and I don't want to say he got upset, but I mean, you know, he kind of cut the question off quickly and said, "Guys, we got chances," and you know, he showed a little bit of attitude. And to me, I mean, I have no problem with that. I'm not criticizing it. I think he should be upset, or you know, you should be fiery at that point if you care about what you do and somebody's questioning it. You know, it's the way it should work. But you know, I liked what I saw from Kessel. I liked what I've seen from day one. It's just how you use that tool.
Bob Arey had an interesting factoid on the telecast, Jason and Jonathan. He was saying that Kessel had no slapshot goals at all last year. Of his 37, they all came on wrist shots. That was stunning to me. I don't know if you guys had heard that before, but not sure that it matters.
Go back to Kessel. There's a website called sportingcharts.com, and it charts what kind of shots guys take. Kessel doesn't take slap shots. It's wrist shots or snapshots. And I don't know how many years they have data. You know, 5 years is probably a solid sample size, but he does not take slap shots. That is not the least bit surprising. I know I did a story when the Penguins traded for Kessel about the whippy stick that he uses, and it's just sort of a style thing. It doesn't surprise me at all that he didn't have a slap shot goal last year.
Yeah, I think he only took, I don't have it in front of me, I think he only took like 17 slap shots all year. So the fact that none of them went in weren't surprising. And you know what? Actually, if you look at that, if you look at those numbers, Malkin's slap shot is actually one of the most dangerous in the league in terms of, you know, percentage of goals, you know, compared to the amount of times he takes it. Makes me think that those two facts are something that might play into a power play if you were to load it up, get all your top guys on one power play. And you got Kessel taking wrist shots from the left half wall and Malkin winding up for slap shots from the right half wall. That sounds really good. It sounds really dangerous. You know, whether it will be or not remains to be seen, but the stats point in that direction.
And going back, Jason, to your combinations, you liked the Crosby-Hornquist-Kunitz line. Malkin, although it didn't work in the playoffs together, was really good with James Neal, who was the sniper. Maybe, I don't know if he's an equivalent to Kessel, but Kessel's closer to Neal, isn't he, than Hornquist and Plotnikov?
Yeah. I don't know how many people have had tell me since I got on the beat that Malkin needs and prefers a shooter on his line. And he's not going to be the type that comes out and says, you know, I need a shooter or something like that. But it works with his game. And it's somebody that kind of gives him some cover and gives some depth to that line, so to speak. And, you know, I've had people throw out Bo Bennett as a guy. I'm not sure that's it. David Perron, I think, could be that guy. Daniel Sprong is the type of that guy. Phil Kessel is the best kind of guy you can get, unless you're going to trade for Alex Ovechkin, which I think is somewhat unlikely. But Malkin likes to, you know, go side to side. He doesn't necessarily like to carry the puck in the zone, and, you know, he's kind of playing this swooping game. I hear that term thrown around quite a bit. But basically what that means is Evgeny Malkin's going to do the work and create the play, and somebody's got to be there to finish it. And it doesn't necessarily make sense to have two guys who like to play a physical game at the front of the net in Plotnikov and Hornquist. And it worked. I mean, that was a physical heavy line through the preseason, so I get why you're not going to break it up. But as far as the long-term thing, I do have questions about whether that's the right mix of ingredients. I'd almost like to see, you know, let's say this tapers off and maybe you give Plotnikov a third-line role and he provides a little heavier presence, and you try David Perron there. Or you try Phil Kessel with Malkin, put Perron up with Crosby. I don't know. I mean, there can be a bunch of combinations that you try. But to me, and Mike Johnston has even said this, you want to get a bunch of different skill sets on a line. You don't want, you know, one and then two of the same skill sets, which I feel like the Penguins have right now with Malkin, Hornquist, and Plotnikov.
I feel like this is also, actually, sometimes after a loss, when people start talking about, you know, changing up line combinations, I feel like it's just kind of like lowest common denominator analysis. You know, just if you can't really...
We didn't blame the goalie yet. Come on.
That's true. Okay, maybe not lowest analysis, but second lowest analysis. And we do it, and I do it, and everybody does it. Because you know, it's hard to watch a game like that and figure out exactly why the Penguins didn't score any goals. And it's easy to say, put Malkin with Kessel. But in this case, I think it's actually appropriate. Just because of the fact that, to me, the reason they didn't score goals was because there wasn't that connection or chemistry among their forwards in the offensive zone. So some days I would feel like the conversation we're having right now is sort of, you know, off base. But today I think it's the exact right conversation to be having.
Where is Perron right now in terms of his role with the team?
He's in
Jason.
Arizona.
I know. It just seems like he had so much impetus to come in shape and have a good off season and to be ready to go. And how's he reacting to being on a third line?
By all accounts, good. You know, I know I went up to him in Carolina and was asking him about the fourth line role that he was in that day, and he didn't seem too pleased about my line of questioning, and I completely understand. I mean, it was one game, and things ended up changing after the Dupuy injury and whatever, but no part of David Perron wants to settle for a third-line role. I mean, I think he's a good team guy, and I think he's going to buckle down and you know, do his job and play that role. But at the same time, I mean, throughout his career, he was a top-six guy. He wants to be a top-six guy, and he went crazy this summer working hard and skating with Letang and all the stuff that I wrote about because he wants that top-six role. Even if he's on a third line, I guarantee you David Perron is still doing that. He wants to score goals and prove to them that he's not a third-line player. And I don't think he's completely wrong. And I would understand any player who says, you know, they have me miscast, so I'm going to go, you know, prove them wrong and show them that I am a top-six guy. So I think if you're going to look at, like, attitude problems on the Penguins, David Perron is the farthest thing from that. He's a good person. He's great to deal with the media, but, you know, he is very much liked by his teammates. They always have a lot of very good things to say about him. He has a lot of good aspects to his game. It's just, you know, I'm not sure it's tailor-made for a third-line role, but he might have to use that third line in order to get what he really wants.
Hmm. Pens Roundtable here on Trib Live Radio every Friday from 1 to 2. Kent Laird, Jonathan Bomboli, and Jason Mackey, who's on the road. One more road game before the home stand begins. We'll talk coming up about the power play, the PK, new NHL features this year, coaches' challenges, 3-on-3 overtime, first reactions to some of those around the league, not necessarily in the Pens games. And the coaching staff, Mike Johnston, and whether or not he will be on the hot seat if things go wrong here over the first couple months of the year. That's all to come on the Pens Roundtable here on Trib Live Radio.
The Medicine Shop on Harrison Avenue in Jeanette. Call 724-523-3550. That's 724-523-3550. Your hometown pharmacy wishes our hometown team a great season. Go Jayhawks from the Medicine Shop on Harrison Avenue in Jeanette.
Hawksworth Garden Apartments in Greensburg. Free heat, air conditioning, electric, water, trash, and parking. 24-hour maintenance, on-site laundry, and on-site management. Income limits apply. Hawksworth Apartments, free application. 2 and 3 bedrooms are now available. Located on 750 North Main Street in Greensburg. Call 724-837-4146.
Trib Live Radio presents the Penguins Roundtable Show, featuring Trib hockey writers Jason Mackey and Jonathan Bomboli.
Wake up, superstar!
Hosted by Ken Laird.
Want to go, pretty boy? Come on.
The best hockey talk in Pittsburgh, right now on Trib Live Radio.
We're going to play some friggin' all-time hockey!
Special teams often define a hockey game. Could make the case certainly last night was it, although the Penguins didn't score and the one even-strength goal that Dallas had did win the game, I suppose, when all was said and done. A third period of lack of discipline. Two power play goals against Jay by Dallas. What did you think of the Pens' penalty-killing unit? Jason Mackey joins us live here from Arizona this morning. And the Penguins have had some replacements to find with Craig Adams gone and Dupuy out. How do you think they handled that?
About as good as they can. I'm not sure it's anything in the how they handled it as much as it is just the personnel there right now. I mean, it's kind of a gamble that the Penguins are taking that they don't have guys who are good penalty-killing forwards. Or they might be. It's just they're kind of unknown. Is Bobby Farnham a good penalty-killing forward? I don't know. He might be. He might turn out to be the best in the history of the NHL, but I mean, it was just his 12th NHL game last night. I don't care what it is, you're going to see some stuff that you haven't seen before. And then, of course, Nick Bonino is the one who takes the penalty. Is, you know, he and Cullen are the only two with significant PK experience. And, you know, Farnham wasn't on the ice for the first goal. I get that. Malkin and Plotnikov were. But at the same time, you kind of have to have those guys go out as a pair because they have to talk, and that's the only way anybody can communicate with Plotnikov. So you're kind of tethered there. Didn't use Kunitz that much. Do you use Crosby and tax him? I'm not sure. And, you know, to me, they're missing at least one penalty-killing forward, and I don't know if there's anything they can do about it. It would obviously help a lot to have Pascal Dupuy. He's so good at that, and they'll get him back. But, you know, even putting him out there with a rotating spot, you know, you rotate that fourth spot between Crosby, Malkin, and Kunitz. maybe Farnham in that case. I really don't have a problem with that, or if Kevin Porter somehow finds his way into the lineup after Daniel Sprong goes down, if that's the way it shakes out, I don't know. But to me, it's just a lack of personnel, and that's even not even an indictment on Jim Rutherford. I mean, I don't have a problem with how they've built this roster. I like that they've gone for goals and they've gone for offense. It's just kind of a byproduct there. And in the meantime, somebody, and maybe Farnham's the guy, is going to kind of have to step up and figure out how to provide a responsible penalty kill.
You know, I've seen Farnham kill penalties before in the minors, and he's not bad at it, but it's never really been like the a hallmark or strength of his game. You know, he wasn't the kind of guys the last couple of years who were up and down who did make penalty killing a specialty were guys like Jason Megna and Brian Gibbons, and Farnham just kind of helped out on the penalty kill. I will say this, he has the tools for it, which is, well, the two main tools being that he's fast and he's fearless. He'll block a shot, probably block a shot with his face if he had to, like that kind of fearless. So, but yeah, inexperienced, and are his instincts good enough? I don't know. But you look at the power play goals that Dallas scored, and like, you know, on the play where Hemsky pulls up in front of Skinneri and shoots, you know, between his legs and goes top corner with it, using that weird little stick he has. I don't know that it matters if Daniel Winnick and Marcel Gotch had been there on the ice at that particular time. I mean, that's a guy making a play against the defenseman.
Although he blew past Malkin like he was a turnstile there, didn't he?
Well,
to get into the zone.
That's true. The entry to the zone was not difficult for Hemsky on that particular play. I'd like to probably get like a 10-game sample on the penalty kill or something like that, just because we're only talking about a couple of minutes here and there. I just thought, I mean, this isn't, nobody wants to hear this, but I thought Alex Hemsky played a really good game.
Oh, he was good.
And I feel like if he plays like that, Dallas looks like that's something that they were missing, is some secondary scoring after that Sig and Ben combination and Spezza.
Even Spezza looked good. I mean,
yeah,
maybe
Spezza
game one, so yeah.
He hit a crossbar. So
Jonathan, I mean, you said nobody wants to hear this. I thought you were going to say the Penguins missed Craig Adams.
No, definitely no one would want to hear that. But I mean, that, you know, I could have said Craig Adams instead of Daniel Winnick or Marcel Gotch. I mean, same guy, same concept.
No, I think you're right, but that is sort of alarming to me, Jason, that Malkin and Plotnikov have to play together. I mean, that's pretty tethered. I mean, if that's really the case, I'm not saying that's a bad move to communicate, but that's a work in progress then.
Well, I guess I shouldn't have said that they have to play together, but you would want Plotnikov playing with Malkin. You don't want Plotnikov playing with Bobby Farnham or Nick Bonino or Matt Cullen or another forward who doesn't speak Russian. And Malkin can play with other people because he can communicate in English. But, I mean, I think people underestimate how much talking there is that goes on the PK. And it's just, I mean, you're doing Sergei Plotnikov a disservice. You're doing that other forward a disservice. Like, you're just, you know, unless it's for a couple of seconds while somebody's changing and somebody just can't get off the ice right then. I mean, the idea is to get Plotnikov and Malkin out there together as a forward pair. So Plotnikov had, you know, he can talk to the other forward.
The power play was 0-for-2, I believe. Malkin drew one, and Kessel got Goligoski a high stick into him. They had some chances. They also had a shorty chance against with Letang getting beat. What'd you make of the power play, Jay, in terms of effectiveness and control?
I really didn't have a problem with it. I mean, for what they were told to do. Now, I don't think that it's the players saying we want to play on two separate power plays. I really don't. And I don't like splitting them into two units. Were it me, I would load up, and I think you have the best power play in the league, or the possibility of having the best power play in the league with all of those guys on one. But for what they did and for what they were allowed to do, I thought the puck movement was good. I thought it was really good on the first power play. They never really got set up that much on the second one. But again, I mean, that even with the best players in the world, that's going to happen. I didn't have that much of a problem with it. I really didn't. They got enough movement and shots for me that I have a lot of confidence that they will eventually fall. And like Jonathan said at the PK, too, it's, I could like at least a 10-game sample size. I mean, we're judging this based on, you know, two or three. I can't remember which one it was last night. But, you know, it's just too small of a sample size. From what I saw last night, though, I didn't see anything alarming.
Jonathan, you're okay with Sid and Gino being separated? That seemed to be the big talking point last night, you know, two units.
I think, I mean, I agree with Jason a lot. I think, like, if I were making that decision, I'd probably load up that one all-star power play just because I think it could be, like, you know, really awesome. But I think you're absolutely fine doing it this way, too. But, and here's the thing about Crosby and Kessel. The idea that Crosby defers to Kessel was deferring to Kessel a little bit too much last night. I feel like even strength, that's absolutely true. I mean, Crosby is a dangerous weapon with a shot. But I feel like on the power play, I sort of like the idea of everyone else on that power play deferring to Kessel's shot as the number one option. I mean, to me, that's part of what makes, like, I look at Washington's power play with Ovechkin in that, at that left dot, and I think that that's, like, the, to me, that's the most dangerous power play there is. And everything is built off the sort of the fear of that Ovechkin shot from that dot. You cannot give that up, and it puts a lot of pressure on a penalty kill. So, to me, if the idea is make sure that the threat of Kessel from the left circle is always ever present, that makes life more difficult for a penalty killing group. So, and if Crosby, and Crosby obviously knows that. So if he defers on the power play and you know, just does nothing but feed Kessel for 2 minutes, I think that's pretty cool. Even strength, different story.
The goal that they gave up that was Dallas's power play in the third period, Jamie Benn's in front of the net on that deflection. He had his skates in the crease, Jason, and that's one of those plays now that if the Penguins wanted to, they could have challenged it and argued goaltender interference. We saw this in the opening night Toronto-Montreal game. I don't know if there was contact there, and you know, I'm not saying they should have, but this is a whole new dynamic in the NHL with the coaches' challenges this year. Do you know the Penguins' operation of what they, you know, who's up above, that's talking to whom, and do you expect a ton of these and to be a story?
Well, going off of what Mike Johnston said, no, I don't. However, I understand where you're coming from, questioning, you know, whether that should be challenged. I also thought it was interesting. I think it was the third period. The Stars had a goal that was disallowed where Ben Lovejoy basically got shoved backwards into the goalie. And I think, you know, maybe Jamie Benn fell or something like that, or maybe it was just Lovejoy that went into Fleury. I'm not sure. But that was one that kind of struck me as something that you might want to take a second look at as well. I wasn't sure that was goalie interference, but as I understand it, Jacques Martin was brought here to be the quote-unquote eye in the sky, that cliche we've said 100 times, and you know, you would think that he would have a lot to do with what that is, and he could have some system to radio down to the coaches. I don't know exactly what that is, to be honest with you, but if you're going to talk about a secondary set of eyes, that would be Jacques Martin.
Yeah, because I think Mike Babcock, Jonathan, said he didn't even challenge it. It was like they had some guy who yelled to the assistant coach, and his assistant said, "We're challenging this," and he said, "Okay." And they did, and they overturned a goal that Montreal had in the second period of that game. So it's really not even Johnston's duty, I guess. They got to have somebody good that they're counting on to know when to do it.
Well, yeah, you got to come up with whatever system works for you. I think we've seen that in baseball over the last couple of years. Different managers have handled it differently, and some have come up with good plans and some haven't. You know what strikes me about that coach's challenge system is how it's going to basically eliminate early game timeouts. Coaches are not going to call their timeouts in the first or first half of the second period, where in the past, maybe if they had a because of the you can't make the personnel change after an icing, in the past they'd use that, you know, when they get a tired D pair out there, maybe even in the first period you'd use that timeout. Now there's no way, because they want to make sure they have the chance for the challenge later. So you never know. That might end up with, you know, a tired D pair being out on the ice. I guarantee you it's going to lead to a goal at some point in some game. I just, you know, you never know when or where that's going to happen.
That's a good thing to ask Johnston tomorrow, too, at the morning skate here in Phoenix. I'll bring that to him and ask him about the protocol for challenging.
And, like, whether that would have been a good one. Because, I, you know, the coaches' challenges, I feel like they're going to be all goalie interference related, or at least 90% of them, Jason. I don't understand this rule half the time. What is, what's a foul, when it's not a penalty, but they just wave a goal off. It's very confusing.
Offsides, too. You'll get a lot of challenges on that, I think.
Okay.
An offsides play that leads to a goal. Because that nothing infuriates a coach more than a blown offsides call that leads to a goal against. They'll fume about that for hours after a game. So I think you'll see that.
Yeah, and that's good to have, I guess. Yeah. The Mike Johnston year two era here, Jason, let's say this goes poorly, and I'm not suggesting it's going to, but they play a bunch of games out of the division here early on, so we're not going to get a real sense of how the Penguins stack up against the Met for a while. But what kind of a hot seat, if any, do you think he's on heading into the year? And if they did make a big push here with Kessel and others. Is there a plan B if they're unhappy with the way this coach is getting the players to respond?
Well, I would think Jacques Martin would be plan B, and I think that's why he was placed in the role that he was. Had John Hines still been here, I think John Hines would have been plan B. But obviously that's not going to happen. I don't want to say they don't want to fire Mike Johnston. I mean, obviously that would be the easiest thing for them, just to win hockey games. But I can guarantee you this, they're not going to let this season go south and just hang on to the coach because he has a contract. I mean, they're not paying Dan Bylsma anymore. Were they, maybe that would give Mike Johnston a little bit of a longer leash, but this team expects to contend for the Stanley Cup. If they are 20 games in and they've got 4 wins or something like that, there are going to be problems, and they're going to seek ways to correct that in season. And so, yeah, if this goes really poorly, and by really poorly, I don't mean like 1-4. Like, people love to get all reactionary over that. I don't mean 1-4, but I mean like, I don't know, if they go through a 9-game winless stretch, or they're, sitting at the bottom of the Met after 20 games or something like that. I mean, I don't think they're going to be afraid to make a change in order to do something to, get this team back in contention, because they do feel like with this offseason, with Kessel, Bonino, Fear, all the moves that were made, they feel like this team should contend. This team should not only make the playoffs, it should go on a run. It should potentially compete for the Stanley Cup. This is every bit good enough, and it's on Johnston to get it to work the right way. So I don't think that they would shy away from firing him if the need arises.
It's funny, Jason, because they don't play the Islanders or the Rangers until after January. So not that that's going to be the end-all, be-all of the evaluation, but those are big games in terms of how your team's stacking up and your coach is stacking up. So maybe they would wait until January, February to do that if they wanted to make the move.
This is such a weird schedule this year, too. I don't even know if they open Metropolitan Division play before October 28th in Washington.
No, that's their first game, yeah.
And it's their first division game, the only one of the first month. Like, they do that, and then I believe they go to Toronto and Western Canada.
Right.
They're in the Western U.S., and they've got all these lengthy trips, but they just have nothing in the division. So, I mean, I guess you're not going to be able to judge results and that sort of thing based on how you do in your division, which is good news for Mike Johnston. Let's not forget they only had 9 regulation wins against Metropolitan Division teams last year.
True.
They dominated the Atlantic. They got the Western Conference. That was fine. It was the division they had a problem with. So theoretically, that should mean good things. But, yeah, just a funky schedule.
And, Jonathan, Washington, I would say, is getting the chic pick as the team to beat in the conference, but it is a tough division. I mean, it was tough last year. We knew that. Might be even tougher this year.
Well, I feel like the Islanders and Rangers didn't necessarily get better. But, I mean, they didn't get worse. To me, the Rangers, because of their defense and goaltending, are always going to be a formidable team. And to me, they're the team to beat in the division. Just because, as much as I love the idea of getting Phil Kessel and adding to your offense and trying to win games, because you have a great offense, defense still wins in the NHL. And so it makes me hard to, not like the Rangers because of that. Washington, here's what I like about Washington. I love their makeup up front. It's like such a classic top six, bottom six. It's like old school. The top six is like all skill, a good complement of Europeans, some Russians in there. And then, because in the old days they thought that only the Europeans had the skill and the Canadians had the grit, and that was it. And that's sort of like how the Washington lineup comes together. And then in that bottom six, you got like Tom Wilson and Jay Beagle and Latta and just guys that are like big physical forces. I really like that combination, that mix. I think I probably like Washington and the Rangers. Not that that's like a huge newsflash or anything like that. I don't know if any of the sort of second division teams, if
Columbus doesn't scare you as much.
No, Columbus does, in the sense that I think that Johansson line with Saad could be the best line. I mean, certainly one of the best lines in the conference, and that's dangerous. Defensively, I'm not 100% sold on Columbus yet, but they're a good team. I'm not that overwhelmed by 13-1-1 to end the season last year or something like that. And I'll tell you why I wasn't overwhelmed. Tyke Redman. I've watched Pirates prospects for so long. They'd come up in September. They were playing meaningless games against AAA pitchers, and they'd hit 400 for the month of September, and everybody would be like, oh, this guy's the answer. And then when it got to be games that counted in April, all of a sudden he wasn't the answer. So let's see how Columbus does when they're playing games that, you know, that matter, as opposed to that 13-1-1 stretch. I'm not saying that I don't think they can do it. I'm just saying, you know, show me.
I started to twitch violently there. I spent the first year of my broadcasting career discussing Tyke Redman and whether he should bat third or not. So it's a bad memory for me. What do you think, Jay? What about the division? And like Philly lost last night in OT. They're sort of an unknown, as the Devils are. But those other teams, I think we know, are going to be decent anyway.
Well, if Philly's looking for offensive help, I would absolutely recommend picking up Chad Hermanson, Ed Sprague.
Jermaine Allensworth?
Add some punch. I don't see any of the bottom three as any bit of a threat. To me, the Metropolitan Division has five really good teams, and one really good team, I think, is going to miss the playoffs. I realize they could still send five, but I'm not as down on the Atlantic as some people are. I think it's a pretty decent division. Jersey's building. Carolina's building. To me, with Carolina, the sooner they realize that they are kind of rebuilding, the better, and they get Cam Ward, Eric Staal, and they get out from under some of those contracts, which I think is going to happen in the offseason, but then they just build and go young. I'm really not sort of blown away by any of those teams. I think Columbus is going to be a playoff team. I like them a lot. I know some people are even picking them to win the division. And I don't know. But if you can stop that line that JB mentioned, more power to you. I don't even know if that's you can call them one of the best lines in the Eastern Conference. I think that's one of the best lines in the entire league. I can't think off the top of my head any line that's, you know, right to left better than that one, honestly. I guess I have some question on whether the Islanders, whether last season was a mirage and they're going to fall back a little bit. If there was one team that kind of blows it, I guess they would be it, or maybe the Penguins, although I don't know how much you'd call blowing a five-game exit from the playoffs. But I do think one really good team in the Metropolitan is going to miss.
Well, Philly got a point last night. I don't know if you guys caught any of their overtime. It was the first 3-on-3 OT in NHL history. If folks missed it, it is entertaining for a 3-minute watch. There are end-to-end breaks everywhere. There was a penalty shot, and the game ended on a breakaway goal. What are you guys expecting in terms of 3-on-3 this year, and do you like it based on what you've seen so far?
I like it. I mean, it's a gimmick, but it's a fun gimmick, and it's a better gimmick than a shootout. So, if you don't want to tie, you know, if you're committed to getting rid of ties, then this to me is the best scenario. I'll tell you what I'm afraid of, and I can't remember where I read this, but I read it recently. I'm afraid the coaches are going to figure this out and take all the fun out of it, because that's what hockey coaches do. So they're going to figure out how to be able to defend 3-on-3, and it's going to turn into, you know, more boring.
They'll go three corners defense.
Yeah, right. I can't picture it in my head, because the 3-on-3s that we've seen have been just end-to-end action. I mean, just great. A lot of fun. I can't picture in my head how a coach is going to take the fun out of it. But, man, that's what coaches should do. People sometimes ask me, what does hockey need to do to get the excitement level back and get the television ratings up? And my number one answer is always ban coaching.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's going to happen, though.
Yeah, what do you think, Jason? Do you like it?
I do think that this might be the one thing that is hockey coach proof.
I mean,
I hope so. About what sort of system can you devise with all that open ice? Like, are they just going to stick invisible traffic cones out there and people just trip over them? Like, I get what you're saying, Jonathan, and I mean, hockey coaches, they'll create a system or some sort of thing to negate everything, and, you know, like you said, they'll take the fun out of it, but it really does strike me as something that is hockey coach proof, and it's going to be fun no matter what. I do think, and JB has talked about this quite a bit in the past, what he's seen in the AHL last year, that, you know, teams went with 2D and 1 forward more than you would expect, and everybody's, you know, thinking that teams are going to go 3 forwards and take all these chances and whatever, but I mean, I think the risk kind of outweighs the reward. So I don't think it's going to be like that, but at the same time, I like the open ice. I like the scoring opportunities. I hate shootouts. I think they are so stupid. I don't think there's a single thing wrong with a tie if you can't settle it after overtime. So if this is what it takes to get us away from the shootout, I'm perfectly okay with it. And I really, if you think about it X's and O's wise and what coaches can do, I don't know what they can do to dilute this other than just say, you know, we're going to go 2D, one forward, and play conservative, which I hope they don't do.
Line three guys up across the blue line and tell them to defend.
Line them in the net.
Yeah, across the net. Yeah, use the goalie as sort of an outlet man so that you can never lose possession. So it's a matter of, like, four corners offense in basketball. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm just spitballing, but I bet you they think of something. I really hope you're right, Jason. I really do, because it'll be a shame if they took something cool and made it not cool, but it's happened before.
Well, Jason, enjoy Phoenix. Will we be talking and will you be writing about Anders Lindbäck getting to his game or being on top of his game? Will we get a freaking goal Saturday night by somebody?
Somebody is going to score in that game.
All right.
If they don't, that's going to be a long flight home.
In 3-on-3 overtime, I'm sure, to break a scoreless tie. See ya. Good job today, and always appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Kenny. See you, JB.
Right. See ya.
Penn's Roundtable in the books. Thank you, Jonathan. We'll talk to you next Friday.
Sounds like a plan.
1 to 2, as always, here on Trib Live Radio. The Penguins Roundtable, a full hour of Penguins talk every week here at TribLive.com. Don't you go anywhere. Big changes in the WPIAL to discuss. 4 classes, the 6 next year. This is a blockbuster. Kevin Gorman's on next with the Kevin Gorman Show. He and Chris Harlan are going to be breaking this down, of course, in all the games, high school football in Western PA. The Kevin Gorman Show next here on Trib Live. Good luck to the Norwin Knights from Dunkin' Donuts with 3 great and convenient locations in your area, including Irwin, Murraysville, and North Versailles. America runs on Dunkin'. The Sports Grill is a relaxing, family-friendly, come-as-you-are restaurant located on Freedom Road in Cranberry Township. At the Sports Grill, the focus is certainly on local athletes, from the little stars on the rise to the Hall of Famers. The Sports Grill has become a local gathering place to showcase all the talents from local athletes. It is truly the local coaches, ADs, players, and the moms and dads who make the local athletic tradition an integral part of the Sports Grill. The Sports Grill features 40 LED screens to watch all the Steelers games, with 3 of them 75 inches. For more information, check us out online at thesportsgrillcranberry.com. That's thesportsgrillcranberry.com.